Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 25th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another science forum. Our panel of experts is back to field your scientific inquiries. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question about anything that a scientist might help you with, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org or 800-348-2551. Always fun. Always in. You learn something, possibly, coming up when we do the science forum. It happens right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Time to reconvene the Science Forum. The experts are here, and they're ready for you. You have a question? All right, give us a call, 800-348-2551. That's the number. Write it down on your wall, and then you won't forget tomorrow, 800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. All right. Yeah, let's get it underway. Let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Hello, everybody. Hello. It's Barbara Brabetz. I am a biochemist at SUNY Cobleskill, currently on sabbatical studying water quality.
Oh, that's nice.
Roger Giaboni, an electrical engineer. I own Roger's High Fidelity, and we're a high-end audio company.
And I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired.
All right, well, let's go around left to right from my vantage point. Barbara Brabetz, how is the sabbatical working out for you?
Well, if most of your listening area is probably seeing those rare raindrops falling from the sky right now, it's been extraordinarily dry. So the Drought Monitoring Center that's out in Nebraska has been keeping us well apprised of the fact that groundwater levels have been dropping. That does affect water quality, of course, because if farmers are applying manure, you know, as they cut hay or they have other factors that they're adding other fertilizers. Usually it travels to waterways, but it can build up in soils. And now on a rainy day like today, it can transport right into your waterways.
So that's not that great.
It's not a great thing, but it's a common thing. And it's something that usually the waterways can absorb. It all has to do with volume or, you know, how much. So too much water, too much manure is not a good mix.
I always say that exact phrase very often, especially the manure part. So you're relaxed, you're waking up later, enjoying yourself?
Yeah, don't you see the smile on my face? I know it's radio, but I'm smiling on the inside and the outside.
Grinning
now.
From ear to ear. Roger, how's biz over at the Hi-Fi?
It's good. We're building new amplifiers every day and making people happy with them.
Now, there was a thing years ago not that long ago, that the Russians were holding back. They make the tubes.
Well, the Americans pioneered vacuum tube development,
right?
And the Americans made primarily for the Second World War tremendous quantities of tubes. So there's still a tremendous amount of new old stock American made tubes out there. But the Russians went into building vacuum tubes, and you know, as part of their radio technology development around the time of the war. And what's interesting is the Russians, primarily for their consumer industry, never stopped making tubes. They didn't gravitate towards solid state for their consumer electronics. So they kept the tube manufacturing plants running.
Because they were waiting for the electromagnetic pulse?
Well, there's an interesting story. When the MiG-25 was developed, the Pentagon was losing their mind about the technology or the anticipated technology associated with the MiG-25. And as one of our clandestine services convinced a pilot to fly one from South Korea to Japan and defect. And when the MiG-25 landed and they, you know, all the hedgehogs got into it and started to figure out what was in, it was all vacuum tube technology.
Amazing.
The Russians claimed it was to have EMP, electromagnetic pulse resistance, but most people today think it was just older technology.
Because they were cheap.
Right. But vacuum tube technology is highly resistant to electromagnetic pulse.
Jim Pickett, what's happening with you, man? You're also, you know, Barbara's on sabbatical. You're retired.
Yeah, I'm on permanent sabbatical.
How's that working out?
That's working out pretty well. I'm still trying to publish some papers.
And, yeah.
Although I may have just done a major faux pas, as they say.
What?
That I had a paper to peer review, and it was not good. So I recommended rejection.
Oh.
And then upon closer examination, the senior author, the corresponding author on it, is in fact the editor-in-chief of the journal I commonly publish in.
So. Good for you. Stand up for your scientific principles.
Yeah.
I mean, what's going to happen? You're already retired, right?
That's right.
Just sounds like a major rewrite to me. Yeah.
Barbara Bravitz, the Ig Nobel Awards have been issued for the year.
Yes, just this month. There was a ceremony. It was held in Boston this year. The Ig Nobel Awards are kind of for dubious, dubious science. Where you're like, really? People spent time and effort and energy and probably money to study that? So the one that's been in the press the most is probably the one, the most colorful.
And the cows. I use that.
Yes, it's the cow one, where they took Black Angus cows and then painted them with white paint that was, you know, bio-friendly to make them look like zebras, because it had been noticed in the field, and some of the speculation as to why zebras are striped the way they are is not just a camouflage issue, but also that it helps with fly strike. So flies are a pest, as we all know, when we step outside, and certainly for grazing animals, that's a problem. And so they studied how many flies would land on the white stripes versus the inherent black stripes on these zebra-eyed cows, and found that it, in fact, does lessen the fly strike problem.
Well, that's amazing.
Yes.
I mean, so...
So give them an award.
So the... I think this is their science here, right? So the flies are taking visual cues?
Yes, of course, yes. And heat, too. I mean, the heat is going to be different on the black side versus the white side.
So referees at football games never get attacked by flies?
Well, only on the black parts.
So interesting.
Yeah.
So is this related to trying to control tsetse flies in Africa?
The research in and of itself is really about domestic. It was aimed as an agricultural project, right? So it's to, the more the cows are annoyed by the flies, the less their milk production, the less their satisfaction, the less that they will spend time grazing. We spend a lot of time on chemical control of flies, which has its ups and downs, right? Anytime you chemically control something, then you have to worry about the effects of the chemical. So this is almost a non-chemical way to control flies. Now, are you going to paint it all white? But it looks as if it's the stripe effect more than it is all white.
As a consumer and a citizen, I want to know how much money the government paid for this.
Oh, I don't think it was a government project.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
That's all right, Jim, you also wanted to mention that quantum mechanics is celebrating a birthday.
Yes.
Ah.
In one way of looking at it, this is the centennial of quantum mechanics, that there were papers produced in 1925 by Heisenberg and collaborators that set the groundwork for modern quantum mechanics.
Wow.
Quantum effects had been known, had been in the literature since about 1900 with Max Planck. And Albert Einstein in 1904 on photoelectric effect. But there wasn't much theory behind it. And there were observations, but nobody really knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And beginning in 1925, things were really started to come together. One of the things I was talking to Barbara about, one of Heisenberg's collaborators was a guy, young man named Jordan, who is about the only one in this whole group of people that over the next 5 years that didn't get a Nobel Prize.
Huh.
And the reason was he had the poor judgment to join the Nazi party and was basically canceled.
Interesting. Now, what did Einstein think of early quantum theory?
Well, Einstein was behind quantum theory. He was left uneasy about the fact that quantum theory does not give a definitive answer. It gives probabilities. And that did not align with the way he saw how things should be.
Do you think some scientists are still uneasy about that? I mean, you want facts that you can... probabilities are good, but facts are better, right?
Well,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, many times in this program, we've talked about quantum weirdness, like the idea, some of the evidence that points to grouped particles that somehow are paired. And it's like, well, how can that be if they're separated by time and space? So it's, you know, it's an interesting theory. Like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, those people that are out there listening probably know that it means that you don't really know exactly where an electron is at any point in time and space. And it's actually, you can know where it is, but then you won't know its speed and direction, or you can know its speed and direction, but you can't know where it is. It's like you get one half of the problem solved, but you can't get the other. And it all just falls out of the math.
I don't understand. I mean, I'm no scientist, obviously. By the way, the number here is 800-348-2551. So if I have a beer in the fridge at home and I see it when I leave and say, oh, I'm going to have you later, and then I come to work, it's gone until I come back and then it reappears?
No.
No? Then it disappears.
The major misconception is that this quantum weirdness also has reality in our world, the classical world. The deal is that it all revolves around something called Planck's constant, which is a number.
Tiny number.
And it's a tiny, tiny, tiny number. It's probably about
10 to the minus 34. So okay. 33 zeros past the decimal place, and then
it's really small. By the time you get even to molecular scale, quantum effects get really hard to see. So what happens is that those quantum effects get entangled into our universe. And that's what we define as the classical world. So yes, your beer stays right there in the refrigerator.
Oh, thank God.
Because it's too big.
It's too big. Yeah, that's the good news. No matter how small it is, even a thimbleful of beer is too big.
So to describe this as being an underlying reality really doesn't make sense because it's not our reality.
We have to take a break here. And I have so many questions, not being all that bright. But if, okay, you know, you think when you learn basic sort of how things work, you have big stuff and then there's molecules and then way down there there's atoms. And now there's something really, really small, but yet the atoms all figure into how things work in the big world.
Yes.
But how can there be this little teeny world that doesn't have any bearing on the big world?
In the same way that the effects of special relativity, which become important near the speed of light, you don't worry about walking down the street because the speed of light is big and you move slowly.
Oh, yeah.
I sure do.
And the deal is that the Planck's constant is 20 orders of magnitude, I mean, inconceivably smaller away from us, small, than the speed of light is big the other way.
Right.
So the quantum world really just does not affect.
So why bother studying it? World,
because it's very important in understanding what does, because what happens on that small scale can be understood and manipulated and is important for scientific reasons and technical reasons.
Nice. And I know you got to go to a break, but if it weren't for quantum mechanics, we wouldn't have reactivity. So we wouldn't even get chemical reactions, which make my world every day.
All right, fair enough. Let's take a break. We're a little overdue. 800-348-2551. That's what happens when I start talking about quantum mechanics. I lose all sense of time. We'll be right back. It's been some kind of day on the lockbox. We're up to $450,983 in the lockbox. Everybody who has made a pledge and a donation to this thing, you're fantastic. Now, we can keep this going. The fund drive begins October 6th. If you want to make your pledge right now, go to wamc.org and click donate. We'll tell you all about the ways you can make your donation to WAMC. But Great job, everybody. The lockbox still has a week and a half to go, and we are rocking and rolling. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's begin in Woodstock. Dave, you're on.
Hello and good afternoon. I recently saw half of a news piece on, I think, Spectrum TV about the some kind of shield to shield us from the EMP or solar flare.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Well, the solar flares are primarily shielded by the already existing magnetic field around the Earth. So most of the lower frequency discharge, the plasmas are shielded by the magnetic field. We still get some radiation comes through, affects power lines and radio communications, that kind of thing.
As I understand it, it's sort of the polarity of the blast, which direction it's
right.
Facing.
Axis, yes.
Yeah, whether it gets
through. The Z-axis is the one that seems to get through the most.
It was a day or two ago, and I'm certain that it was on some kind of NASA program, possibly with satellites.
Well, satellites are outside of that magnetic field, so they're very susceptible. Absolutely.
So shielding satellites is a different thing.
Shielding satellites are we do that already. We do that already.
What'd you say, Dave? Say it again, Dave.
Shield the Earth with satellites, Susie Cell C cells. To shield the Earth with satellites, it was a major program to shield us all from the.
I don't think that's possible.
Be a lot of satellites.
It may be a matter of detecting when the flares.
Can I have a follow up?
Sure. Go ahead.
But they're already doing that. They already have solar.
About the dark matter and dark energy.
Yeah.
And as it relates to the digital world.
Okay.
You were saying something got weird. Someone said the word weird. Weird quantum effect?
Quantum weirdness is just a term that's used to generalize the difference in behavior of very, 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 very small particles or light compared to our heavier things like protons, neutrons, atoms, molecules.
Okay.
And that has
what
nothing.
What has your experience?
That has nothing to do with dark
digital
energy.
Digital seems to be weird to me.
What'd you say?
I stay away from digital just for myself.
I hear that.
Abhor it as much as possible.
Good job,
as
Dave.
As for dark energy and dark matter.
Yeah.
Perhaps, is it still 94%? We don't know what it is?
A little less than that.
The composition of the universe.
Of the universe's mass?
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
And is.
Go ahead.
I think, just think good thoughts in general, but perhaps that the, it's getting bad press, dark energy, dark matter. I think it could be called sparkly jelly and things like that.
That's a good idea. We'll put that forward. Jim, you're a well-known, eminent scientist. You could do that, right?
I'll put it on the internet.
All right, Dave, thanks for getting us started. 800-348-2551, that's the telephone number. Let's go to Steventown. And Marka, you're on.
Yes, I was listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he was talking about the salinization of the oceans and that the rivers flow into the ocean, but the ocean holds on to the salt. And I'm wondering why large lakes don't do the same thing.
Well, we got a water expert here. So.
Sure. Many large lakes do if they're not connected to an ocean. So if you think of like the Great Salt Lake, the Dead Sea, they're surrounded by terrain that's higher than they are, so there is not a natural flow out to the ocean. So other lakes recharge and discharge on a periodic and annual basis. So if you think of like even Lake George, right, there are exits from Lake George that end up in the Hudson, and I think it's the Hudson, and then the Hudson flows to the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. And what happens is the low amounts, the low quantities, low concentrations of sodium and potassium and chloride, those are the three biggies, magnesium, there's a couple others, For the most part, anything that's a plus one or a minus one ion that reaches the ocean doesn't really then form something else, right? But the plus twos and the minus twos can get together. So, for example, limestone is calcium carbonate, so calcium with a plus two and carbonate with a minus two. They can come back together, but the plus ones and minus ones, it's kind of a one-way reaction. So the problem is that reaction happens over 4 billion years. You've got that accumulation in the oceans. There are some processes that can capture it into rock. At the bottom of the ocean under pressure, but it's a very, very slow process considering the fact that we have like an annually renewable supply of water here on the surface of the earth.
Or oceans or seas evaporate and then it becomes salt deposits.
Right. And you know, some areas of the oceans are getting saltier because evaporation and the heating of the planet is such that it's happening faster than the replenishment of those materials from fresh water. And then in other places, you have the melting of glaciers or ice caps either of the poles that is then contributing fresh water to the ocean, and then it's becoming a little less saline or less chloride ridden. So the problem is it's really a stratification. You get areas. We're not mixing as well in the ocean as we used to.
Why?
Part of it's heat, right? So if you have a hot top and a cold bottom, hot water rises and cold water sinks, so you don't really get good mixing. If you don't have any cold water that comes and infuses into that hot water, you don't get kind of like the up and down motion of the water and the mixing that's necessary.
All right. Mark, you want to follow up very quickly before we let you go?
Thank you. You answered my question and much more. Oh, great job.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate
what I aim for.
Satisfied customer.
Generally speaking, the number that I hear a lot is it takes about 38,000 years from a drop of water to start at one location and then go through the whole hydrologic cycle, the whole global water cycle, to then end up in the same place at the same form. So.
All right. Number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Utica. Let's all head out to Utica. Patrick, you're on.
Hey there. First of all, happy Cosmos Day, although that's technically, I guess, Sunday. It's been 45 years since Cosmos first aired, which is kind of a watershed moment, thanks to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, who ironically will be shuttering their doors 2 days later. Anyway, I was calling to kind of mount a defense for the Ig Nobel Awards, because sometimes the science might sound, you know, on its face kind of ridiculous. But we don't always know all the details or what the applications will be. I remember vividly in the 80s going into Walden's bookstore and picking up a science magazine and having a brief discussion with the cashier over something that I had just read in one of the magazines, and that is that they were hooking up machines to monitor the methane coming out of sheep and cows. And we both thought this was just ridiculous. Now, fast forward to the late 90s, early 2000s, there have been and more recently, there have been multiple studies that show that animal agriculture is a significant driver, not just in ecological damage, like, say, with the agricultural runoff causing algae blooms in the Hudson River, but also as far as things like climate change. And the worst case scenario is it's something like 51% of the global warming impact coming from animal agriculture, although I don't think anybody takes that seriously. The numbers from the other studies seem to be settling around 14 to 16%, which is significant in that it matches or exceeds the estimated impact coming from all of the vehicles on the planet combined. So, you know, sometimes these studies might sound a little crazy, but, you know, come to find out there's a really practical reason why they're doing it. Or sometimes they don't even expect, you know, that what they're doing is going to have implications or utility elsewhere. And then it ends up being very helpful. And I just want to transition to the quantum anniversary. It's worth noting that about 6 days ago was the anniversary of the release of the 6502 processor, which was where the computing revolution really began. That was the least expensive processor available. And it's worth noting that Apple, Atari, Commodore, and a whole bunch of European computer companies that nobody's ever heard of here all standardized on that. And like, you know, anything using transistor technology, they're using quantum tunneling inside of those gates. So anyway, that's it.
I like that, Patrick.
Thanks for tying it together.
You want to comment on that?
Oh, just that he has a very fair point about the Ig Nobel Awards. As much as it's bizarre to think about painting cows to look like zebras, they did in fact find that the zebra painted cows were less annoyed by the flies. And that means that less energy for those cows that are an agricultural product are being spent on something that's not producing a product. So, you know, he has a fair point.
Yeah.
Well, as they say, the Ig Nobel Awards are for work that make you laugh and then think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This email came in before the show from Nick. My house has forest behind it that was a quarry for the Ashokan Reservoir. There's an open field area near the main road where the ground stays frozen much later in the season and will also be frozen when nothing else is, even with more sun. Is this because so many rocks are deposited there and maybe flattened for parking 100 years ago, or could it be the foundation of a very old building totally buried?
That's a great question. Our colleague Ed Stander couldn't be here today, and he's a geologist. And he suggested that if we have a geology stumper that he could take it for homework.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so maybe you should pull that out and give it to me,
I'll make sure we can get the answer
in October.
There you go.
After the fun drive.
All right, fair enough. That's right. Oh, thanks for bringing up the fun drive. Yep. Hang on. Oh, I got this.
Oh. Ray's doing calisthenics to get it off the floor.
Oh, I'm ready to take a nap now. Glenn writes in, okay, so we had the caller asking about this. I think he saw half the news item on TV, and maybe he didn't get the full gist. So this is from Glenn in the 845. Solar threat early detection missions. A trio of solar threat detection missions, including NASA's Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe and Carruthers Geo-Corona Observatory and NOAA's Space Weather Follow-on Lagrange 1, launched together on September 24th, 2025. That's yesterday, according to this email. All three spacecraft are headed toward the sun. The L1 Lagrange point, a stable orbital position about 1,000,000 miles from Earth. So that's from Glenn.
Yeah, we've been using satellites for solar monitoring for decades.
With the SOHO and some of those other ones up there, right?
I don't remember, but they're usually NOAA and NASA satellites.
Yeah. Right, and you can go to spaceweather.com to see a real-time image of what the sun is doing, and then they give you an interpretation with a quantitative kind of assessment as to what the potential threats are and when they would get here.
Right, they'll actually tell you what radio bands are performing and which ones are not. It'll tell you whether you've got power line risks, that kind of thing.
You know,
I actually have it right here on my phone, on the front of my phone.
Me too.
You too?
How are we looking?
Roger.
How's the weather?
Well, let me. I don't know
actually,
what the cell
phone
signal.
Actually, the bands are good right now.
Oh yeah, the ham bands.
Yeah, R1. So we're good. Only a minor issue right now.
All right, and Roger, when we get blasted with an X1, whatever, what happens to the RF bands, the radio bands?
So it depends on the frequency, okay? So VHF frequencies, VHF and UHF frequencies, typically above 50 megahertz, tend not to be affected because they're line-of-sight communications, very much like optical communications. Lower frequency communications, what we call HF communications, typically a megahertz and a half, 1.5 megahertz to 30 megahertz, primarily they rely on bouncing off the ionosphere for propagation. So they're worldwide communications bands because they bounce, the waves bounce off the ionosphere.
In a fairly predictable way?
No.
No.
I mean, in a somewhat predictable way. Heaviside and a few of the other scientists started studying this back in the 20s, but it's a semi-understandable way. They still come up with new experiences where, you know, they've installed beacons now that broadcast at a regular time period at certain frequencies, and people study the beacon propagation.
So that's for what they call high frequency and I guess into even medium wave. What happens? And I was always fascinated because all the old shortwave radios had the long wave. And as I understood it, it was used often for submarine communications.
Well, that's VLF, very low frequency.
What happens? We talked about quantum and very small scale physics things. But what happens with low frequency and extremely low frequency?
So low frequency, very low frequency, and extremely low frequency. Now we're talking about 5 kilohertz. They propagate via ground wave propagation, not ionospheric bounces. Okay. And what that means is they basically resonate the Earth's surface.
Or the water.
Or the water. Right. They resonate around the local structure. And it makes it, not only is it somewhat impervious to solar flares, but it's also impervious to EMP. And the United States government built an entire communication system called GWEN, Ground Wave Emergency Network, was designed to communicate after the event.
You have to have some serious size antennas.
Huge antennas. Yeah. And then they became a problem because they became lightning magnets.
Oh.
We built this equipment at RCA in Camden, and it was difficult.
Couldn't you bury the antennas?
You did. You buried the counterpoises.
So halfway
you
down,
you buried
halfway.
Half of it.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. Yeah, we've been all over the map, but that's what happens on the Science Forum. Back with more of your questions in a moment. Joe Pass doing Sunny Moon for Two here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett is here. Roger Jaboney and Barbara Brabets. Ed Stander has the day off. It's okay. He had a valid excuse. He sent it in. Barker writes in, how come seawater will foam up from either its own waves as they crash upon the shore or coming off the bow of a boat or ship or from the props while freshwater will not foam?
Oh, that's a great question. I've always wondered that myself. Freshwater does foam, but usually it means that it has phosphates in it. Phosphates are part of what we need to absorb in order to make cell walls and or actually cell membranes. I'm going to get it right or I'm going to get letters. And also, like, our DNA has phosphates in it. So it's an essential nutrient. But so when you break down organic matter, so previously alive stuff that's now dead, and it kind of gets washed into water, it can create these foams. We harvested it as an idea because the thing about phosphates is they have a polar head and a non-polar tail. So it makes them good detergents.
Mm.
And so back in my early childhood, detergents that you would buy for like your laundry had phosphates in them. And then what we found is that they were causing harmful algal blooms as they were discharged as wastewater. So in most of the states of the United States, phosphate detergents are not allowed for household use. You have to have a special permit, la-da-la-da. But the oceans, of course, it gets everything. So my suspicion, although I'm not sure, is that the foaming that we see on shore really comes from that breakdown of organic matter and the phosphates that are in the water. You know, you're at shore, and that's where the nutrient loading is going to be the greatest.
And the agitation is the greatest.
And the agitation, just like your washer, right? You get the foaming.
Yeah.
That's my suspicion. But anybody else have anything to add?
And maybe the organic stuff is a little less soluble in seawater because the organic stuff doesn't like salt.
Yes, right.
And so you may get a little more scuzz on the surface.
Scuzz, good word. That's the word of the day.
That's a technical
term. It's on the periodic table.
Scientific term.
SZ on the periodic table.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Kingston. David, you're on.
Hey, hello there. Ray, I was thinking what you had expressed earlier in the show was a kind of confusion
yes,
on the topic
I
of
do
the,
that a lot.
The mechanics
yes.
came up. And I mean, well, we all share it, but another way of looking at it that might help you feel a little less confused is if you think about the way comic books or newspapers print a picture, there are thousands and thousands of tiny little dots that make up that picture. Now, when you look at the picture, you don't see the little dots. You see, let's say, a flower.
All right.
But if you were to zoom in and look at the dot, you might be able to do all kinds of modeling, precise and accurate modeling about just that dot, the shade of gray or whatever.
Right.
You could do all kinds of precise analysis about the dot, but you'll know nothing about the picture of the flower. Likewise, you look at the flower, you could determine its bloom, its blah, 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 all the kind of botanical information, precise analysis about that flower. You will learn nothing about the dot.
Huh, okay.
That's the nature of the way the scale has the impact of scale upon our analytical ability.
I think the only thing that muddies that analogy is the statistical nature of quantum mechanics, whereas halftones, in your, like your example, are very, you know, very, very statistically negligent.
I think that that's a good, but overall, it's a good analogy that.
The world that
we live in emerges from the quantum world.
David, I appreciate you trying to help me, but I'm afraid I'm a lost cause at this point. But thank you very much, and that was good. 800-348-2551. The scientists already know. They don't even have to bother with me. Let's go to Shelburne.
So not true.
Ted, you're on. Hello, Ted. How you doing, buddy? He's still there.
Ted gave up on us.
Is Ted alive? Hello, Ted. Oh, boy. We put Ted to sleep. I'm so sorry, Ted. All right, let's go to Bennington then, and we'll go to Chris. Chris, you're on.
Is this me now?
I don't know. Is it?
This is Ted in Shelburne.
Ah, well, it says Chris in Bennington, so I'm going to call you Chris. Hello, Chris.
Well, yeah, you call me anything. Speaking of the lightning and antennas, and then I'll get to the real question, but I was once very close to it, and the flash and the sound was right about the same time, and I kind of felt it, and I went outdoors, and some slightly buried barbed wire in this old fence line had boiled itself up out of the ground.
Wow.
So that's as close enough.
Holy moly.
For me. And also, I would love to hear updates on improvements. I mean, I hear them some from international listening, but on solar panels, there's one that is thinner and gets slightly different wavelengths and can increase solar electric generation. And the fact that there are some large applications. In Chile, there is a train that is battery run. And in Japan, there is a small tanker running fuel oil around. So a lot of what we sometimes hear in Vermont, that gloom and doom, and we have to have fuel in our trucks, needs adjustment. I'd love to have some talk about that. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, the efficiency of solar is a complicated argument. Because there are applications, as he mentioned, if you're going to put solar panels on something that moves, for example, you're very limited in your area. So you may be able then to afford to put on expensive, very high efficiency technology. Mm. For solar farms, however, the area is relatively cheap. And what you want, and silicon panels are good enough at about 20% efficiency and cheap to make, so you cover a little larger area with those. So I don't think that there's new technology that's going to displace the silicon solar panels, except in very specific kinds of applications. Mm. Like on satellites, for example, they go with the absolute highest efficiency because, you know, every gram counts.
Yeah.
So, but it doesn't count if you're putting it in a field.
If you think of the analogy of like gas mileage, right? We could make a car that gets 100, 150 miles to the gallon, but it'd be enormously expensive. It wouldn't hit the curb weight regulations that we have here in the United States. So, and then, of course, we can create a hog that gets only 5 miles to the gallon. What you want is somewhere where your costs are lower, but you still get some efficiencies. And I think that's where the market is now. And it's really been able to expand significantly because the price of the panel is not the problem anymore. I mean, they're relatively cheap. As Jim has worked on this problem for many years, I think the next battle will be how to recycle them because they're all new, right? We've had these things on the grounds for maybe 20 years at the most.
Problem.
Right. Yeah, it's a problem. And what we're going to find is, what are we going to do with these things when they've run out their expectant life,
yes,
and now we have to put new ones in?
And they're
in.
Working on the recycling, but it's a sticky wicket.
It is a sticky wicket.
It's hard because the adhesive that holds everything together sticks really, really well.
On purpose.
A solar panel is a bunch of wafers, very thin wafers. Is that it?
Well,
it's like a club sandwich.
Yeah. So you have a hunk of glass, and then a layer of adhesive, then your silicon wafers, then another layer of adhesive, and then a plastic film on the back.
Why do you need the glass and the plastic?
Well, you need the glass to give rigidity and to protect it, and the plastic film on the back to keep liquid water out.
Ah, okay.
But the problem is that the sticky stuff is almost impossible to get that
apart.
Yeah,
your mayonnaise is a little too good on the club sandwich, if you know what I mean.
All right. Now, remember we had this issue where Ted from Shelburne became Chris from Bennington, and Chris from Bennington became Ted in Shelburne. Let's go to Chris in Bennington and see who he is. Chris, you're on. Not working.
Hey, I'm Chris from Bennington.
Hey, you're success. A winner. Go ahead.
So I was in East Africa in the late 90s, and we ran into some folks in the Peace Corps who were building solar stoves for folks as for cooking. And their premise was that cooking fires were a significant contributor to carbon emissions. And I just wondered if that was valid or anything on anybody's radar.
It absolutely is. In fact, one of the world organizations, I'm not exactly sure if it was UNICEF or one like that, sponsored a contest to come up with the best, cheapest solar stove and then has used that to disseminate across communities where wood is a problem or where the education of women perhaps is not complete because the women have to go scavenge for firewood. And so in order to be able to kind of fix those social problems that exist within those societies, the solar stoves were given out. They're enormously efficient and very cheap, like less than $50. I mean, that's my ballpark, but it's like really cheap.
Same with water filtration.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of it was a matter of quality of the air inside the houses or
what
or
you mean outside. As far as what the problem was? Yes,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
fuel. It's global climate change, of course. It's time, right? These things are very efficient. And it also is quality in the houses. So all of these things are improved by the solar stoves.
Chris, thanks a lot for that one. Let's go. Now, okay, I'll give you the choice. New York, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Massachusetts. Barbara?
New Hampshire.
Roger?
I don't know what I'm picking.
Massachusetts. And Jim?
Yeah, New Jersey.
All right, let's find out what Chesterfield MK is in. There is one in each of those states. MK, where are you?
I'm in Massachusetts.
Roger
bingo.
Wins.
All right, go ahead. You're on.
Oh, I was just wondering, what are cobwebs? They're certainly not from spiders.
Got the wrong guy for that one.
What are cobwebs?
They're proteins that are excreted by the spiders.
Yeah, yeah, they're from spiders, but they're kind of like trapeze lines that the spiders use to travel from place to place. And then what happens is after they exist for a while, then our household crap gets stuck to them, whether that be dust or dander or hair. And that's when they take on a life of their own and become dust bunnies, right? They move from one zoological entity to another because they've accreted all of the household dander that's in your...
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
MK, you want to follow up?
Well, I don't see any spiders in my house.
Aren't you lucky? They don't but have to be a big spider to make the cobweb. Yeah, they can be little. Sorry to say.
And they're almost
there.
Surely there.
They're there. And I mean, I love spiders. I mean, spiders,
I do too.
They eat all kinds of things that you don't want in your house,
I
right?
I agree.
So there's a book I read when I was a kid called Be Nice to Spiders. Ever since I've been a complete brainwashed person. I don't kill spiders in my house, but when the big wolf spider kind of stares at me from the tub.
They're handsome.
I give them transport outside.
Yeah. MK, thanks a lot. What do you think it is about our human psyche that instinctively we'll see an eight-legged thing and kind of freak out? Why?
I think it's not furry, right?
There are furry ones.
There are furry ones. What am I saying? Like those wolf spiders. It's just so alien. When you go outside of mammals, I think you're kind of limited in like the human psyche of what's cute. I mean, and there's many exceptions, but we tend to think of like these furry, baby-like, not too big things. I mean, I work with many students who would say that spiders are the cutest thing that they've ever seen, right? Because I work in an ag and tech school, so we have herpetology and we have, ornithology and
did they have to intellectually train themselves to get over a visceral reaction?
Well, I'll tell you a story. We have emotional support animals on campus. It's a thing that's been going on
Emotional support spiders?
No, they're banned.
All right.
Actually, they're not banned. So we had to come as, and I was in governance at the time, and there was discussion with the administration and the faculty as to which animals could be support animals. Given the fact that we're an agricultural campus, you know, you can't exactly have a cow clomping through the dorm as an emotional support animal. Yeah. So we knew it had to be limited in size. And so sheep were determined to be not an eligible ESA because they carry diseases that can't be tested for, and we have flocks on campus, and so it was going to be a biohazard problem. And then an administrator who has since retired said, and we can't have any reptiles. And I'm like, what's wrong? You can have emotional support bearded dragon. Like, they can be very friendly.
Oh, come on.
And, you know, I don't own any emotional support bearded dragons, but it was a valid question coming from a scientist to query the status quo.
Was that Ed who brought that up?
No, it was me. No. And the retired administrator said, well, they're just icky. And so I'm like, well, I don't know what box to check on this form for the just icky part of it. So, you know, we all have our biases, yes.
But I do love spiders. And when my kids freak out, I say, we got to keep this guy.
Yeah, they're getting rid of the fleas in the house. You want to keep the fleas?
Well, how do you know we have fleas? Let's go to Barry in Hartford. Hello, Barry, you're on.
Oh, boy, I have a quandary going in my mind. Maybe you could help me. I find that I have a problem between the word reality and theory. I don't understand how a scientist can make such a commitment to something that is so vague as a theory. As like an example, there was a one time that the Earth was considered to be flat, and a round Earth was a theory. So can you help me with the definition of a theory as opposed to reality?
Okay. We have about a minute here, so go ahead.
Okay. It's important to distinguish between a scientific theory and a hypothesis. So a hypothesis is an assertion, almost a guess.
Right. The moon is made of green cheese.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Okay. Now, those are vague, and you don't want to commit too deeply to your hypothesis. In science, though, a theory is a body of facts and math and understanding that explains a phenomenon. So general relativity is a theory of gravity. It's not a guess. It's not a hypothesis. It's a theory.
And it's testable to a certain extent.
But it could be wrong, ultimately.
Well, how do you ever test
something? It has limitations.
Right. How do you ever test something to surety?
It's more like that it would be incomplete. You would find something which explains everything that explains and something more.
So Einstein's unified field theory that he was questing for was something that would have explained it all.
Yeah. But it didn't work out.
Right.
So...
But theories typically provide the models for people like me who are engineers to be able to use those models to apply that science.
So there's the
but it has limitations.
Piece. Yes.
Yeah.
So, and I would even push back that hypothesis is just a guess because it has to be a testable guess.
Yeah.
Right? I can't guess if your beer is in the fridge when you
over.
Close the door unless I have a means of testing it, like putting a GoPro in your fridge and then leaving it there when you close the door is the GoPro showing. Right. So the testable part needs to be there for the science piece of hypothesis.
All right, Barry, we're going to have to leave it there, but that's a great question. And feel free in a couple 6 months call again because we will have forgotten and then we can do it again. All right, Barbara Brabets. Can anybody follow your work, your unsabbatical here, your water work?
Actually, there's two things. The college is having a college information day on Monday, the 29th of September. And so if anyone's interested in the next round of admissions, they can go to that or go to our www.colbleskill.edu and hit the admissions button. But I will be at the Riverlink Park on Indigenous Peoples /Columbus Day with water results from the Mohawk River as the Seneca Chief replica comes down the Erie Canal to celebrate its 200th anniversary.
Love it. All right, Roger, how do people find your gig?
Rogershighfidelity.com.
Jim, do you want anyone bothering you at all now in your retirement?
Stay away.
Fair enough. Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum at Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. and the Southlands Foundation Community Day, Rhinebeck, inviting listeners to 200 acres of preserved countryside for pony rides, farm animals, crafts, music, food, open to the public Saturday, September 27th, southlands.org. Once again, thanks to Barbara Bravitz, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Two in a row now, 2 weeks in a row, Jim Mountier. Splendid job screening the calls. Thanks, Jim. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. We'll talk bread baking with Graylin Bauer of Sparrowbrush Bakery, William Wilson Keenan of Bakery Suzanne, and the great Amy Halloran. We'll break some bread. We'll bake some bread. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.